Before we get started on today's episode, I wanted to share a quick announcement with you guys. I'm doing my first live show coming up on Sunday, October 29th at Downtown Drafts in Gainesville, Georgia. I'll be there sharing some spooky local stories to get everyone into the Halloween mood. I don't know how many of you may be local, but if you are, it's your chance to see Obscure Appalachia live for the first time. You can check out the pod's social media page for more details. I hope to see y'all there. Now on to today's episode. Hey y'all, we're going back to the Parkersburg, West Virginia area today. Ground zero for mysterious Appalachian stories, apparently. Indrid Cold and Valiant Thor are two mostly average-looking guys who are said to actually be extraterrestrial. But were they, and are they actually the same person? I'm Candace, and I'll be your guide. In October 1966, two young boys were walking down the street in their New Jersey neighborhood. One notices a man watching them and points him out to the other. They report seeing a tall, bald man wearing a green metal suit and sporting an unnaturally wide smile. The boys report that the man began to chase them, and they ran until they got away from him. After the fact, they recall that aside from the man's unusually large grin, he also had unusual features, and that the man was lacking his nose and ears. Around the same time, over in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the Lilly family reported unusual experiences that felt as if a poltergeist was in their home, as well as seeing diamond-shaped lights in the sky. The Lilly family daughter, Linda, was sleeping one night when she was awakened by a man in her room standing over her. She stated the following, quote, "It was a man, a big man, very broad. I couldn't see his face very well, but I could see that he was grinning at me. He walked around the bed and stood right over me. I screamed again and hid under the covers, and when I looked again, he was gone," end quote. This recollection is interesting given the context, but I need to note that I only found the story of the Lilly family recorded in one source and only briefly, so you may want to take that one with a grain of salt. However, the bulk of the stories of the grinning man were recorded by one man, Woodrow Derenberger. Derenberger lived near Mineral Wells, West Virginia, and worked as a sewing machine salesman. One night in November 1966, just a couple weeks after the boys in New Jersey were chased by the grinning man, Woodrow Derenberger was returning home from a business trip when he spotted lights on the road ahead. Thinking that the lights were from a stopped police vehicle, he stopped his truck. But then he realized it was not a police car. It was a cigar-shaped craft that he explains was shaped like a kerosene lamp chimney, roughly 45 to 60 feet long. Much to Woodrow's surprise, a man stepped out of the strange craft and approached his truck. The man gestured for Derenberger to roll down the window, and he complied. Derenberger later recounts in an interview that the man looked just like any other normal man with normal features. He had distinctively olive tanned skin and dark hair that he wore slicked back. The unusual thing, as you probably guessed, was that the man had an unusually large grin plastered on his face and kept his arms folded across his chest with his hands under his arms. The man began speaking to Derenberger, but as he spoke, his mouth never moved from that eerie grin. Woodrow realized that he was hearing the man telepathically. They had a brief exchange where the mysterious man seemed to be confused why Derenberger was afraid and told him not to be afraid, that they didn't wish him any harm, only happiness. He got Woodrow's name and occupation and told him his own, that his name was Cold and that he was a searcher, without elaboration. He then told Derenberger that they would see him again, got back on board the ship, and it lifted off into the sky. Woodrow later explained that the craft had landed entirely across the two-lane highway, that after Cold returned to the craft, He tried pulling his truck onto the shoulder to get around it, but could not. He also notes that there are other witnesses, as he saw several larger trucks come past the spacecraft in the other direction. When Woodrow went home, he was understandably shaken by the events and told his wife what had happened. While nervous about scaring the children, she ushered them upstairs and listened to his unbelievable story. The following morning, Woodrow called the local police to report the experience, and he was interviewed by local media, which quickly became a media frenzy. It turns out he was correct. There were other witnesses. One family even reported that the craft shone a bright light onto their car during their drive. The day following reporting the initial encounter to the police, Woodrow encountered cold again. He was driving through Parkersburg, West Virginia with a friend when he felt a tingling feeling in his forehead, and he immediately knew it was cold trying to make contact. He initially resisted. He wanted no part of this, but the feeling wouldn't pass. So he finally complied and just let the thoughts in. The friend who was with him later admitted that he knew something was weird because he had a feeling he couldn't explain around the same time that Woodrow received those messages. Cold mentally relayed to Derenberger that he needed to slow down and drive carefully as his ship was right over the truck and they were following him. Cold then goes into some detail about himself and where he's from. He states that he is from the planet Lanulos in the galaxy of Ganymedes. Their planet is much like ours, also with oceans, lakes and streams, mountains, and similar plants and animals to ours. Cold explains they've taken samples from our local plant and animal life, and tests deduce that they are very similar to what is found on Lanulos. Their life expectancy, however, is longer than ours, with the population living on average 125 to 175 years old. Cold explains that he has a wife, Kimmy, two sons, and a daughter, Kimmelis, that was only recently born. And finally, he tells Derenberger his first name. And this was the world's real introduction to Indrid Cold, who's sometimes referred to as the Grinning Man. With this, the news of the Derenbergers and their extraterrestrial friends exploded. People began gathering at the Derenberger homestead in hopes of seeing a glimpse of Indrid Cold or any mysterious lights in the sky or strange people. Woodrow's wife, Marjorie, was afraid of the aliens that had been contacting her husband, but she was even more afraid of these hordes of people gathered outside of their home. However, the Derenbergers were very hospitable people and wanted to share their stories. So after long days and evenings working, Woodrow would often invite the crowds inside, serving cookies and coffee to anyone willing to listen to these engaging stories, often keeping the Derenbergers up until 3 or 4 in the morning. Finally, after an especially long evening at work, Woodrow arrived home late to find about 150 people huddled outside his home, and they just had enough. They called the police to clear the people away. All of this was very hard on the Derenberger family. In addition to the lost sleep, the kids began getting bullied at school, with classmates saying that their dad was a liar. People began scheduling business meetings, seemingly interested in sewing machine purchases, only to really want to discuss aliens and Woodrow's encounters. Eventually, their business and livelihood began suffering, and the family exhausted their savings, forcing them to move into a cabin that had previously been a summer home for his wife's family. However, shortly after their move, people began seeing mysterious lights in the sky over the river behind the cabin, leading to the public's discovery of the family's new home. To make matters far worse, when the press learned of the strange lights, they published that the lights were following the Derenbergers, leading more people to crowd around their home. In the end, they had to move multiple times to find peace and only tell very trusted friends and family where they lived. Woodrow was interviewed by NASA, the U.S. Air Force, and NICAP, the National Investigations Committee for Aerial Phenomena. While the authorities always dismissed his experiences as weather balloons or satellites, they continued to want to meet with him to discuss his experiences further. One government official explained that his allegations would cause public panic, and they couldn't have that. Derenberger was sent to multiple doctors and assessed for epilepsy, chemical imbalances, and neurologic disorders, but doctors never find any medical evidence explaining the events. One night when returning home from work, as Woodrow was getting out of his truck, he received a message from Indrid stating that he and his friend, Carl Arlow, were sitting on the Derenberger back porch. They didn't want to go inside to risk alarming Marjorie and the kids, so Woodrow sat outside in the cold to talk with them for about 2 hours. They explained that there had never been war on Lanulos and that their race is in no way superior to humans, except in the way that they couldn't fathom hatred. Telepathy is apparently the key to preventing miscommunication, as ideas are relayed from the heart instead of being muddied with words. They further explained that their technology is only more advanced because they've had hundreds more years than we've had to develop it. They were also fascinated by Woodrow's accounts of different cultures and beliefs, as there isn't any diversity on Lanulos. They end the night by inviting Woodrow onto their ship, which he declined. He walked them back to it, about 100 yards behind a barn, and watched them depart. Woodrow Derenberger worked with a local author to tell and publish his story, Visitors from Lanulos, to further spread the word about his experiences, as he no longer met with any press or the public. I read the book during my research for this episode, and let me tell you, it's a ride. I do recommend reading the book for yourself if you're interested in the story, as I'll only be hitting some highlights from here on out. It is pretty packed with information and experiences. A couple of days following the back porch discussion, Indrid and Carl visited again, and once again, they asked Woodrow if he would like to go aboard the ship. This time, he obliged. It's as sleek and modern as you'd expect from a spacecraft. Woody spots a blue panel on the wall with a light behind it and places his hand over it. And with that, the door slammed shut. He momentarily forgot about the whole telepathy thing because he had a moment of panic about how they were going to trap him inside and abduct him against his wishes, leading to laughs from Indrid and Carl, explaining that he's the one who shut the door when he touched the panel and told him to just touch it and open it again. Woody wasn't comfortable enough to travel on that day, but he would travel with them on subsequent visits. When Indrid asked him where he wanted to go, anywhere Woody wanted, he didn't know why he responded the Amazon jungle, but he did, and that's where they went. He noted the sickening vibrations as the ship traveled that the crew was accustomed to. The crew was large and consisted of both men and women, all very friendly. After hovering over the Amazon and getting a nice view, Indrid explained that they wouldn't be allowed to land anywhere, but they could travel and see anywhere Woody liked. He even extended the offer, stating Woody and his family could live on Mars, Venus, or even Lanulos, and that his family would be appointed positions there so they could work and live. They did go on to make many flyover visits to the moon, Saturn, and eventually Lanulos, where people waved to Woody through the spaceship window. It seems the decision that they couldn't land was reversed because in the book, Woody explains that he visited Indrid's home and met his family. The book goes on to detail various outings to destinations mostly in our solar system, but some outside, how Indrid and Carl befriended his daughter Tanya, and they often spotted his ship while out and about, and how Woodrow met and befriended aliens from various planets that he is still in contact with. He also learned during this time that the planet Lanulos was populated after a crashed spacecraft landed and could not be repaired, and its occupants populated the planet. That crashed spacecraft was from Earth. Y'all, I know, but bear with me and we'll talk about all this in the final thoughts. Up to his death in 1990, Woodrow Derenberger maintained his story, although never speaking about it again publicly. His daughter, Tanya Derenberger, who passed away this year, carried on her father's legacy, working with authors much like her father did to tell the story of her life with Indrid Cold. Now, to be honest, I didn't read her books. It seems only one of which was published in any accessible way. One, because I don't have endless amounts of time to get these episodes out, and two, because of the reviews. While Visitors from Lanulos was definitely out there, Tanya's book, Beyond Lanulos, Our 50 Years with Indrid Cold, is said to be incredibly outlandish. And while I consider myself to be open-minded, that's just not my style. I did, however, watch the interview with Tanya Derenberger that Infinite Rabbit Hole podcast did last year, just a few months before she passed away. Tanya explains that during her childhood, there were long stretches of time, sometimes a couple of weeks, when her dad would disappear only to return with no recollection of where he had gone or what had happened. She details that her family became such good friends with the Colds and the Arlos that they would bring their families to visit, and Tanya and her brother would play with Indrid's kids, Connor and Connard. So yeah, that's Connor and then Connard with a D at the end, taking cardboard boxes outside to slide down the muddy hill behind their home. She recalls that the boys didn't have winter coats, so they would find some old or outgrown ones to loan them. They also had never seen hot dogs before the Derenbergers made them during a visit. Tanya explains that these visits were a big deal, as women were not allowed to travel on spacecraft per the rules of Lanulos. They apparently had a very old-fashioned mindset on gender roles, so they had to obtain special permission from the Intergalactic Council for Indrid's wife Kimmy and his daughter Kimmelis to visit. The council allowed the traffic as they understood what close friends the Colds and Derenbergers had become. It also doesn't hurt that Indrid was the head of the Intergalactic Council at that time, and that that role has now been passed down to his son, Connor, or Connard, because the names are so similar I couldn't tell exactly which one she said. Back in 2020, Tanya was awoken one night to a figure standing at the foot of her bed. When she reached for her lamp, she was instructed not to turn on the light, but she recognized that it was Indrid. He had been badly burned, which is something she explains happened at the end of her most recent book, and he didn't want her to see him like that. She asked where he'd been hiding all that time, and he explains that he'd been hiding in the Appalachian Mountains, in remote areas, because he didn't want to be too far away from Tanya. Somehow, despite him having been missing for a long time, she explains that they watched Hellier together in 2019, and he pointed out all the inaccuracies. Hellier is a show focused on the story of Indrid Cold. Indrid apparently keeps up with media on Earth, Tanya says, and may even listen to podcasts. The final point I took from this interview is that apparently Indrid maintains his refusal to ever let the Derenbergers take a photo of him because he's afraid it may fall into the wrong hands. Now, who is Indrid Cold? There are so many theories, one being that Derenberger was correct and it's as simple as him being extraterrestrial. Others claim he may be a dimensional being as he could suddenly appear at will, it seems like. While others believe he could be Valiant Thor. Now, there's a lot to the story of Valiant Thor, but I'm going to have to get through this as quickly as I can for many reasons. The primary being that I don't want this to be a two-part episode. More on that in my thoughts at the end, though. The story of Valiant Thor was introduced by author Frank Stranges. Frank was a founder of the former National Investigations Committee on UFOs, as well as the president of the organization International Evangelism Crusades. Frank wrote the novel Stranger at the Pentagon, which details how in 1957, a man approached DC police and telepathically communicated that he was an extraterrestrial and wanted to meet with the president. He was a normal-looking man, not even a strange grin this time. And after telepathically persuading several members of security into allowing him clearance, he walks in and meets with President Eisenhower and Vice President Richard Nixon. He explained who he was and invited them aboard his ship, which they explained they could not comply with due to security issues. When asked where he was from, he phrased it, quote, "I come from the planet your Bible calls the morning and the evening star," end quote. Apparently, this is the planet Venus. His people live underground on Venus and traveled easily to Earth. He introduced himself as Valiant Thor, as well as explaining that his mission on Earth was to encourage its people to follow Christianity and help mankind return to the Lord. According to Frank Stranges, President Eisenhower and the U.S. government responded to these claims by putting Valiant Thor into a nicely furnished apartment and allowing him to participate in government for 3 years in an appointed role. Frank Stranges claims to have met Thor when a government official whose pseudonym is Nancy Warren just bypassed all government clearance to invite him to meet Thor at a barbecue. At this get-together, photos were taken, and one of an average-looking man is in the novel purported to be a photograph of Valiant Thor. The novel details how Thor's uniform he kept on board the ship was indestructible by any of our technology, and how he could materialize anywhere at will, and often did that to consult with Stranges. And in fact, anything could be materialized at will. The ship had incredible medical capabilities, which could repair anything, body or object, in the blink of an eye. Thor's crew supposedly installed holographic communicators in homes of trusted confidants throughout the world, and Frank Stranges claims to have seen one of these in L.A. The novel goes on to detail how Stranges was seemingly poisoned during a trip to Germany, but one of his coworkers had been given a powder antidote by someone who didn't tell him what it was or what it was for and just gave it to him just in case. So his coworker felt he should mix it into water and give it to Frank, and it miraculously reversed the poison. And despite Thor's ability to materialize at will, he did call Frank to check on him after he felt that there might be a problem. In another instance in the novel, Frank was accosted by 3 men in suits who began beating him with the intention of killing him, and he fought off all 3 trained assassins on his own until help from Val's crew arrived to dispatch them. When Frank asked Thor how his planet was created, he explains that in the beginning, God created Quello. That's the planet, Quello. But the people aligned with Lucifer, so God banished all the people of Quello and created Valiant Thor via a hand of fire coming from a lake and created him as a messenger to Earth to prophesize. In another instance of Frank being a victim, he claims a car that had been previously parked on the shoulder of a road pulled out just as he and his wife approached, causing a car accident. Frank was injured, although not severely, when Thor materialized in the hospital, laid his hands on Frank to heal him, and the hospital staff was stunned and amazed at the miraculous turn he took. According to Frank Stranges, Thor had a mission end date in 1960, where he claimed he would have to go home. And the book does claim that Valiant Thor vanished in 1960 and then concludes with a long description of the rapture. I know you're wondering, as was I, if there was any other documentation of Valiant Thor aside from this novel, and no. I found absolutely nothing official noting that this person existed or that any part of the story is true. The Eisenhower Library had to appoint a specific person to handle any inquiries of Eisenhower being in contact with any alien life, and Herb Pankratz, the archivist on this assignment, denies any involvement. The night Eisenhower supposedly met with Valiant Thor, it is well documented that he was having dental work done at that time. And no, there is no distinct connection between Valiant Thor and Indrid Cold's appearance a few years later. I'm sure people drew this conclusion largely based on their commonalities, like their human forms, telepathic communication, and the fact that they had spacecraft. Tanya Derenberger, in her interview, also said that she does not believe there is any connection between the two, and that the editor for her father's story, Andrew Colvin, encouraged Woodrow to state that the two were connected, and her father refused to lie and say that they were. Whatever your beliefs on the stories of Indrid Cold and Valiant Thor, it's undeniable that they're a fascinating component of Appalachian mystery and intrigue. Indrid Cold is commonly said to be related to the Mothman somehow, due to his appearance in the same area around the same time frame as our favorite cryptid. But there doesn't appear to be any link between the two of them aside from that. Okay, y'all, that's the story of Indrid Cold and Valiant Thor. We're going to talk about it, but first, I have a disclaimer. My thoughts on these stories will probably be the harshest, most cynical ones that you've heard from me yet. If you want to revel in the magic of these unexplained entities, and I understand that feeling, you may just want to head out. Sometimes you don't want to hear a story that you like being torn to shreds, or you just don't want the negativity that day. But I have to be honest about my thoughts. So if you want to hear them, here we go. Oh my God, y'all. When I started the research for this episode, it was only supposed to be about Indrid Cold. But the more I found about people's theories, obviously I had to dive into Valiant Thor as well, since people connected the two. In initial research, both of these guys were so intriguing. The Indrid Cold-Derenberger connection really captivated me. Until I read both of these books. I was on board with Derenberger's account for a while. It's generally a pretty believed story in the paranormal community because he did maintain his story until his death, and he did suffer a lot of consequences by telling it. And that obviously lends credence to the story. But I started falling off when they invited Woody to explore the ship. My faith was dropping as they started traveling. And y'all, I lost it when he claims that Indrid invited him to live on Mars or Venus. I just can't. I don't have to explain to y'all why that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. There are so many inconsistencies, big and small. Woodrow claims the ship took up both lanes on the highway and he couldn't manage to pull around it at all, but several tractor trailers managed to clear it just fine. And women can't travel on board the ship because women aren't equal on Lanulos, but there are female crew members on the ship. But it's okay, because the Intergalactic Council, conveniently headed by Indrid Cold, okayed it. And finally, if I had any faith in Woody's story up until now, the people of Lanulos came from Earth. And Indrid told Woody they were more technologically advanced because they'd had hundreds of years more experience making technology than we'd had. So is that suggesting that there was an earlier race of humans that were technologically advanced enough on Earth to pilot a spacecraft to Lanulos? And we don't have any evidence of that? Or is this suggesting that Neanderthals managed to create a spacecraft? I have no idea. I can't. Then the interview with Tanya. She claims her dad would disappear for a couple weeks at a stretch with no recollection of where he'd been, but I didn't see any mention of that in this book. There, he just recounts all of these intergalactic travels. Is it that he really believes he had these travels, but didn't want to tell them to his family? Or did he just truly not remember where he'd been? And if that's the case, what is he writing in this book? Because in this instance, it doesn't make sense for Cold to wipe his memories because they're supposedly besties, right? While I was believing potentially the initial contact with Indrid Cold, maybe even the second one when Cold told him the ship was near the truck and told him about his life, the more I read, the more absolutely ridiculous all of this seemed to me. I know a lot of people believe the story, and I always hate to make negative assumptions about anyone, but I have to say I believe at best that Woodrow Derenberger was mentally ill. It would explain everything, including his disappearances, how testing didn't reveal any medical problems, and that he may just genuinely believe all of these things happened. I also think it's pretty telling that of all the places Woody claims to have visited with Indrid, they were almost all places that he had some knowledge of. The moon, Saturn, the Amazon, all places he could picture in his mind. Lanulos was the only place that was somewhere unimaginable, so to speak, but Indrid told him it's a lot like Earth. That to me is another compelling argument for mental illness, because it seems logical to me that it would be a lot harder for your brain to invent somewhere brand new than to fill in the gaps on somewhere you have some level of awareness of. And if that's the best case, that Woody was mentally ill, what's the worst case? Was he trying to craft a convincing story to sell a book? Did he need a story that would help him get away from his family for weeks at a time for something else he had going on in his life? Does a sewing machine salesman really stay at work that late that often? And maybe it really was just all made up or exaggerated for whatever reason. And maybe with his kids being bullied in school for their dad being a liar, he never felt like he could come clean or just didn't know any way out. Now, there were other witnesses to the initial sighting of the ship. So it is possible that there was a UFO or something unexplained and everything just spiraled from there. And I know none of this explains Tanya's claims, but Indrid has been in her life her entire life. She's met with him even shortly before her death, played with him and his kids when she was a child, all of that. It's plausible that she only wanted to maintain her father's story, so she just kept it up all this time. Maybe she enjoyed or benefited from the small amount of fame the story brought or from her own books. Maybe that's a reason to maintain it. Who knows? I haven't put that much energy in understanding why Tanya would also fabricate this. I just know that I personally don't believe it. Of course, there's always a chance that all of this is true, but I just can't buy it. And oh boy, that brings us to the story of Valiant Thor. First, let me mention that the Thor part of his name is in all caps, like it's an acronym or initials, but I couldn't find any explanation for what it may stand for. I wish I could have gone into more detail about Stranger at the Pentagon for y'all, but to be honest, I have so much information on these stories after reading these two books that if I did, it really needed to be a two-part episode. And after getting this far into the research and this freaking disenchanted by these stories, I outright refuse to make this episode the one directly preceding Halloween. I guess at the same time, it's a little bit of a refreshing change of pace to have a story that I outright disbelieve, although that wasn't my original intention. Typically, I gravitate to what I believe over what I don't. So while my final thoughts may be questioning about things, they're usually not outright negative. And God, y'all, I felt like I lost brain cells reading these books, especially Stranger at the Pentagon. Let me start by stressing this point to you. My loathing for this book has nothing to do with Frank Strange's religious beliefs. I support anyone believing what brings them personal peace and happiness as long as they're not hurting anyone else. But my God, if you tell me you met a space alien and they believe exactly what you do, and more importantly, the exact message you make money spreading, I'm going to assume you're lying. It doesn't matter what that belief is. So for a Christian evangelist to tell me that Valiant Thor was appointed by God to bring Christianity back to the forefront on Earth, right off the bat, I don't believe you. There's just too much vested interest and potential profit looming for that to be a believable message for me. Going on, to be very blunt with y'all, in writing at least, Frank Stranges is not a likable guy. Every anecdote he relates in his novel is riddled with his own accolades. He relates the story of his supposed poisoning in Germany to the conference he was invited to attend, what he was speaking on, the accolades he received, the experts present who praised him on his work. You get the gist. Every story that he has in this book, every experience was like that. This book is so egocentric. It alternates between Frank Strange's praising himself and his accomplishments and evangelizing. The scene I described where he was riding in a car with three trained assassins who threw him out of the car and began to attack him was honestly just so laughable and I couldn't even take it seriously. It was like a bad movie plot. To think that three men trained to kill attacked him, and in the most kind way I can say this, Frank Strange's, judging by his author photo, is not a particularly imposing man. And he bravely fought them off with some hidden martial arts talent he discovered within himself in that moment, escaping only with a scratch and a pair of broken glasses. Come on, seriously? And then when Thor arrives in a car, despite having the ability to materialize anywhere or materialize anything he desires, he couldn't fix Frank's glasses and said they'd have to get back to the ship's miraculous healing powers to fix them. Then, of course, let's not forget the minor car accident that was supposedly the Men in Black trying to take him out, that his wife wasn't hurt at all in, and he only had minor injuries but was miraculously cured. When Thor popped in and out of the hospital and the doctors and staff literally gasped in amazement. It seriously read like a clickbait headline. Doctors are astounded at this one miracle cure. It was so bad, y'all. And all that is aside from the obvious that we're expected to believe an alien strolls into the White House and is given a furnished apartment and a role in government. I guess the only upside to my time spent reading this trash book was the description of the space bidet and how it operated. Okay, I think y'all get the picture. Kendra Cole could have been an entity people have seen. Hell, he could be an alien. But none of the rest of this makes sense. And Valiant Thor is a work of fiction and a poor one at that. Considering Frank Strange has made his living from holding conferences and spreading the word and selling tickets doing that, because that was a facet of his job, it seems to me he created this figurehead to speak more and sell more tickets, to sensationalize his beliefs. That's my final thoughts on this episode, and I hope y'all still like me. So what did you think about this episode? Let me know. I'd love to hear all of your opinions. Do you believe the stories? If so, you can tell me. Your thoughts might just be different from mine. You can reach me on social media at Obscure Appalachia, or come see me at the live show if you're local. If you're a fan of the podcast and would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/obscureappalachia. All Patreon funds go to pay the hosting and software fees to keep the episodes coming. If you have your own paranormal stories, I'd love to hear those as well. You can send those to obscureappalachia@gmail.com. Next time you hear from me, it'll be the Halloween episode. Thanks, y'all. Until next time.